Is mental illness to be treated as a purely material problem, or is mind disease spiritual only, with no legitimate role for psychiatric drugs? Or is there a third option? That's the continuing topic today of Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
I'm your guest host, Mike Keyes, and we're going to continue our conversation with J.P. Moreland about his new book, Finding Quiet. And the subtitle of that book is My Story of Overcoming Anxiety and the Practices That Brought Peace. So in the first episode of this series, we broached the general idea of the a human person as being composed of both a material and an immaterial or soulish part, and how they are intimately related to each other, and how good practices in mental health take this into account. JP, thanks for coming back to continue this conversation.
Well, it's my pleasure, Michael.
So I kind of gave a summary already of where our first conversation went. So let's launch directly out into some somewhat new territory. Now, this is more an epistemological question, JP, reflecting on our earlier conversation. What level of confidence do you have in the reality of these non-material or soulish aspects of humanity compared to what scientists, particularly natural scientists, can know about the human condition? I know you're in favor of investigating both the material and the non-material, but how would you compare your confidence in the existence of the soul compared to the existence of with a certain theory about how synapses work in the brain?
Well, I think that the arguments for the soul's reality are so powerful. Sadly, most people don't know those arguments, but if you look at them, they're so powerful that I know that the soul is real. Could I be wrong? Yeah, but so could synaptic theory. And I know the soul is real, and it is far more rational to believe in it than to be a materialist. That's where I'm at on that. I don't want to freak people out, but I am more certain that the soul is real than there is such a thing as the brain. And that's because if you go down to the level of atoms, if we could shrink down to the level of atoms, we would discover that the brain is largely empty space with an arrangement of atoms and molecules that are millions of miles apart from one another at that level of analysis. The brain, therefore, turns out to be something like a cloud. Is a cloud real? Well, it looks real from, 10 miles away, but when you get close to it, there's no boundary to it, and it's largely empty space. And so what I think a cloud is not a thing, but it's just an arrangement of water vapor that's arranged cloudwise. And if you take the scientific picture literally, then the brain does not exist. It is actually just an arrangement of atoms and molecules that are arranged brain-wise. It is an aggregate of parts that fit a certain arrangement, but it's not a thing. Now, I believe there is such a thing as a brain because I believe the soul informs the body. But if you're asking me, there are really good arguments that the brain doesn't exist from assuming a materialist view of the world now. And I am very, very strongly convinced the soul is real. So if I had to give one up, I'd probably give up the brain, though I do believe in both.
Sure. And I'm sure if you had to have brain surgery, your brain surgeon would be very grateful that you believe in both. So, okay, how should people of faith view the findings or claims of the social and natural sciences in regard to the human condition, including how to deal with practical problems like anxiety and depression. So this is more kind of how do you integrate the social and natural sciences and from the perspective of, let's say, a Christian worldview.
Well, thank you, Michael, because in the book I address this. I showed that the Bible constantly affirms the wisdom of unbelievers, and it praises the wisdom of the Egyptians, and so on. And so the point that I make in doing that is to show that the Bible itself recognizes the existence of extra-biblical knowledge. John Wesley put it this way: to imagine none can teach you but those who are themselves saved from sin is a very great and dangerous mistake. Give not place to it for a moment. Point being that the Bible recognizes that we can learn things from unbelievers and from nature. So my approach is that if something contradicts the Bible, if a neuroscientist says we've discovered that there just is no soul, or if a therapist says what you really need in your self-actualization is to start being more sexually free and have sex with several people, that's out, because if it contradicts the Bible, it's false. But if the Bible doesn't speak to it and it doesn't contradict the word, then I'm old, just like we have pianos and guitars in church, because the Bible doesn't speak about that, I am free to follow the evidence wherever it leads. And if there's evidence that medications and that a certain kind of therapy or certain practices work, then I will follow those if I find them helpful, unless I get to a point where it contradicts scripture. So I think we have full freedom to avail ourselves of all the findings in general revelation that seem reasonable and helpful, provided that they don't contradict the scriptures and that they don't replace the scriptures, because the scriptural aspects of healing anxiety and depression are absolutely critical to this whole thing.
You know, as I was listening to you, JP, about, you know, how from your Christian worldview perspective, you can freely follow the evidence from the natural sciences where it leads and integrate it properly into your overall view of the world. It reminded me of some of the great historic founding fathers of science, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, who had a Christian or largely Christian worldview, and they also used it as a way to guide the way they did science and integrated it with their Christian faith. So all that to say, such as this is all parsed out in my book, Unbelievable, you're in good company, JP, to articulate the view you just argued.
And I'm glad to know that I'm in good company.
Okay, good. All right. I'm especially glad that we're in company together here having this conversation. So, yes. And I might mention that that JP has authored a number of books related to these foundational issues about science. I mentioned Naturalism, A Critical Analysis, and Body and Soul, Human Nature, and the Crisis in Ethics. So all great stuff. Now, you talk about the in your book, JP, the integration of the soul's faculties into the life of an embodied person. To what degree does thinking affect feeling and vice versa? And how is this similar to what physiologists and sports science specialists refer to as muscle memory?
Oh, what a question. Well, actually, thinking can really trigger emotions. In fact, the way we engage in self-talk, which is the way we talk to ourselves about, we beat up on ourselves and talk about how scary the future is. And a lot of times this self-talk is almost subconscious. We're not aware of it because we're busy doing other things. And then we end up in the afternoon scared to death and nervous and anxious and wonder why. And it's because our thoughts shaped the triggering of certain anxiety emotions. And of course, emotions can affect thoughts. The thing that I want our listeners to know is twofold. First, In the book, I want you to know that I give you a real basis for hope. If you're suffering from anxiety or depression, I want you to know that you can change. I want you to have hope because there are things that you can do to get better. The second thing that is probably one of the most important ideas in the book is that anxiety and depression are largely, not entirely, but largely habits. And those habits are ingrained in the different members of our body. Just like, and that's what Paul was talking about in Romans 6 about presenting the members of your body to God as instruments of righteousness. A golf player has golf flesh in his wrists and arms, let's say, not his hips and legs. And what that means is that his muscle memory in his arms and shoulders are contrary to be getting good at golf. So I say, present those members of your body to a golf instructor as instruments of golf righteousness to get rid of your golf flesh. And what I mean by that is, I want you to go to a golf instructor, and he's going to tell you something to practice with your club and your arms, your wrists, and so forth. You have to worry about your hips and legs. They're fine. So repeat those practices over and over and over and over and over and over again. And if you do that for a few weeks, guess what? You will get rid of the bad grooves, your golf flesh, the grooves that make you swing poorly, and that will be replaced with new muscle memory grooves that are golf righteousness, that is, that are conducive to being good at golf. And that's exactly what Paul means in Romans 6. So if anxiety is a habit, that means that there are grooves in our, mainly in our brains and our heart muscle and our nervous system, that automatically trigger anxiety and depression without us choosing it. What we have to do is to regroove those regions by presenting our brain and our heart muscle to God as an instrument of shalom and flourishing. And I have in the book practices that, if done repeatedly, will eventually get rid of those triggers and naturally form your character to trigger peace and joy instead of anxiety and depression.
By the way, JP, are you good at golf?
You know, sadly, no.
So your flesh and your forearms and so on is not really well regrooved in a golf righteous way?
I am filled with golf flesh, let me tell you.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad that you focused your mind on your own inner experience as well as thinking about the soul and the body and the brain, the heart, in order to write a book like the one you did. And so let's wrap up our conversation in one more episode. But thanks so much, JP, for discussing your book, Finding Quiet, subtitle, My Story of Overcoming Anxiety and the Practices That Brought Peace. And that last bit you were talking about, by analogy to muscle memory, is all about those practices. So let's pick up with our last episode in with some things about some particular practices that you recommend. So thanks for joining us at Mind Matters, JP.
You're so welcome.
All right. I'm your guest host today. This has been Mind Matters. I hope that you will check out JP's book, Finding Quiet. Go to Amazon or your favorite online bookstore and check out this book.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.